Coming up next on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, Resistance Radio, and I always like to say Persistence Radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we are fortunate to be speaking with Justin Reed and Priscilla Mendenhall. Justin Reed is the director of African American programs at Virginia Humanities. Virginia Humanities produces cultural and civic programming such as Virginia Festival of the Book, Virginia Folk Life, the radio program With Good Reason. You have probably heard of these. We want you to know about is the African American Programs, which explores the complex and rich history and culture of Virginians of African descent, acknowledging that African American history is not separate from the mainstream Virginia story. Rather, it is integral to any fruitful understanding of life here. We're going to learn about some of the fascinating explorations the African American Programs is undertaking, and we'll hear about a case in Virginia so integral to the landmark Brown versus Board of Education decision, yet one that many of us know nothing about, that some say helped ignite the civil rights era in America. It's about how the desegregation movement in Virginia began, and it was sparked by a 16-year-old girl from Farmville, Virginia. And we welcome back Priscilla Mendenhall. She is an equity activist who has been advocating for immigrants' rights for over 40 years. In 2017, she created CIRAC, the Charlottesville Area Immigrant Resource and Advocacy Coalition. She was here exactly 1 year ago, illuminating CIRAC's work to give hope and help to families in peril because of the inhumane conditions imposed upon them by this administration. We'll hear an update about what immigrants in our community face on a daily basis, the increased need to intervene regarding jailings and ICE notifications, their rapid response network, and how you can get involved. Now, Nancy, we've waited long enough. Are you there?
Ellen?
Yes.
I'm here, and I'm happy to say at least for another week, I am here not on the ledge. I owe it all to those, I think, of late, the latest two women, Anna Maria Archia and Maria Gallagher, the two at that elevator that put the last bit of soul into Senator Flake yesterday. I mean, that was just... Yes. Obviously, I know you're aware of all that, but I had given up. I know it's only a week. I know it doesn't necessarily mean anything, but at least it happened.
Yep. If you're hopeful, that really means something. And also, it was just such a passionate, heartrending plea by those two women you mentioned, the protesters. And if, I was just thinking, if ever there was an elevator speech, that is the one to remember. They said so many things, so passionate, like you have the power when so many women are powerless. And he really, you know, he could have reacted in such a different way. And we saw by his action that it really, I think it really made a difference. But, you know.
I know. You can't call him a hero. I mean, he's doing his job, but apparently a lot of senators in the GOP don't want to be doing their job. So I am very grateful to all of that. And I have to say, I mean, if I was in the elevator business, that would totally be this marketing strategy. I would get everyone together and just say, you know, not only are these suited for taking you from the first floor to the 90th, but for engaging in democracy, for bipartisanship. They're perfect for that. You know, I was just like, who would have thought? The lousy freaking elevator. Thank God he didn't take the stairs.
And thank God there was a camera there to capture it. And he said that, you know, that I know that impacted him, but he also had said that even if this is not a partisan vote, he said, let's have a bipartisan process, which I appreciate. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It was almost, you know, it was another time warp. It was just like, so you guys do know why you're really there. You just really choose to be, you know, belligerent to each other and not get anything done, and yet for a minute, you know, I, as I alluded to, I'm not counting anything as anything except that for a week at least, Mr. Kavanaugh gets his background checked finally, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I know it's, you know, this whole limited scope thing, but if they find something, they can definitely pry into it.
Yeah. I mean, he's obvious, in my opinion, he's obviously lied. And I have learned that even if they don't get enough evidence from people from way back then, though it sounds like they will get, you know, more backup for Dr. Ford, that he has lied. And in and of itself, when someone that's, you know, applying for a job like that lies to the Senate repeatedly, you know, that in and of itself, you know, is mm-hmm. enough. So
Did I cut you off?
No.
Okay. Did you know that he had decided a case that allowed polygraphs to be used, that they could be used in an investigation and a criminal investigation and an investigation like this, that he had decided on a case like that in favor of polygraph? And when Dr. Ford was asked, she, of course, said, that's fine by me. And he actually, I don't think, answered the question as to whether he would want to be subjected to a polygraph. I just thought it was interesting. A lot of karma in this case. I think.
And he was all over the, you know, Bill Clinton's impeachment and getting him to say as much lewd stuff as he possibly could get the guy to say, and was, you mm-hmm. know, totally unwilling to share, not necessarily that, but anything about himself. You know, he was lying about those drinking games. He was just lying.
Right. And there's a lot of questions of his credibility that go, you know, that have been raised before this. So I'm hoping that this goes in the right direction, and we know what that means. And speaking of the right direction, everyone can head to see the Liberal Redneck. They're coming to town. The Well-Read Comedy Tour will be here October 5. That's this Friday. And guess what? We are giving away free tickets. So that is at 7 o'clock this Friday. If you want pairs of tickets that we are giving away, we're going to ask a question towards the end of the show. And it'll be a trivia question based on the content of this show. And then you can send us the answer. Contact us any way you know how. That's Facebook, Twitter, or our email, which is aosradio947@gmail.com. aosradio947. So, I also wanted a little plug for that show. Whoopi Goldberg wrote on the Liberal Redneck page. And actually, they were here, Nancy. That was like one of our most famous guests. We're in the studio with us. Like about a year ago or so. Whoopi Goldberg said that
I think we were responsible for the success of the first tour.
They are really, really funny. He became famous with his viral videos. And Whoopi Goldberg said that the shows are as funny as hell, thoughtful and moving for reasons you'd never think to be moved by. And go see them on stage. You'll be shocked and driven to hear them. But I caution you, wear diapers. You're going to need them. Diapers for the laughter, I'm hoping. I don't know. Anyhow, so
Terry, to segue to the Tomtoberfest
today, right?
Yeah.
The
today,
reggae.
Yes.
If you want to hear some really good music, a guest that we had in last week was really, really impressive guy, J-War and Vibe Riot. They're going to be at Tomtoberfest at Ix Park today at 9 p.m. He makes amazing music, and he's very deliberate about what he puts into his music, as well as the venues he plays, and he has a message of positivity. So go support J-War and Vibe Riot and rock out.
Yes, expunge the week's events, because there will be more. Anyway.
Yes. So we have an excellent show today, and I would like to introduce Justin Reed. He is the African-American Programs Director at Virginia Humanities. You have probably heard of many of Virginia Humanities programs. They're formerly known as the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. They do the Festival of the Book, radio programs like Backstory, and with good reason. Well, Justin Reed is the director of African American programs there at Virginia Humanities. What I wanted to say about the program is, you may not know about that program. We're going to hear if it's new, because I hadn't heard about it. But they explore the history and culture of Virginians of African descent. And they acknowledge that African American history is not separate from the mainstream Virginia story, but it is integral to any fruitful understanding of life here. I really like that. So we're going to learn about some of the fascinating explorations that they do and a very interesting case that we'll let him talk about. So welcome to the program, Justin.
Thank you for having me here. Excited to be with you.
Yeah. So what is it that you would want us to know? Let's just talk about the African history programs first. What is your mission? What is important for us to know about?
Yeah, so African American programs has been around for a while now. Okay. I think probably at least 20 years. And I think one thing people probably don't realize is that even though we are our own special program, we collaborate across the organization. So, you know, African American programs is working with the Virginia Festival of the Book, working with our Folklife program. And so all the well-known, well-publicized programs that we do, the more public-facing event-focused programming, still has support from African-American programs. And so all of our work throughout the organization is integrated.
Okay, that's helpful. I understand what you mean. That's great.
And then the one that we were not able to get you on to talk about but was really successful was the one called Unmasking Seville. And I was wondering if you could tell us about that three-day.
Right. So we hosted the series called Unmasking Series. Unmasking Seville was a three-part series. A young, talented journalist, Central Virginia native Samantha Willis, who at that point was working with Richmond Magazine. They co-hosted a series in Richmond called Unmasking RVA. And it was phenomenal. I unfortunately couldn't attend, but I saw all of the reaction kind of unfolding online. And one of the things that really made Unmasking RVA appeal to me was that it was very youth focused and seemed to be very different than the typical conversations around race and racism. You know, it was incredibly diverse. It was driven by millennials and Gen Xers. And I think it just had a rawness to it that was needed. And so we reached out to Samantha Willis, and you know, she very graciously agreed to help us create a version of that series here in Charlottesville, and you know, reached out to an incredible group of local partners to make that a reality. And again, in conversations with some of our local partners, you know, a few things kept emerging. You know, we needed to have a series that wasn't dominated by the University of Virginia. Typically, you know, whenever we talk about history of race in this community, it's always UVA led. We made the conscious decision to have experts who were all natives of Charlottesville, who maybe if they've maybe attended UVA weren't affiliated with UVA in any capacity right now. And it was really important for us to really create this platform for Charlottesville natives to speak out about the history of race in their community, because I mean, it brings so many different issues to light when you can say, this is what my grandparents experienced. This is what my parents experienced. And so it was really important for us to have those voices. And then again, we worked really hard to make this a program focused on young voices. Again, when we have conversations about race and racism, it always steers towards older generations who are kind of reflecting back on race and not really tackling some of the contemporary issues. Or if they are, it's sometimes with this, like, you know, condescension toward the younger generation. And we definitely didn't want to have that. I think we were really successful in really capturing and amplifying those voices. So, excuse me, I'm on the tail end of a cold here.
Oh, wouldn't have known. Well, you know, when you talk about young,
very white right now.
When you talk about young people, I really need to segue into the thing that I alluded to, the story I alluded to before about a 16-year-old girl who really made a difference. And there's been so many instances in history, the Arab Spring, the movement now with gun control, those kids, where kids are teenagers. Youth are involved in really sparking a lot of the movement. So can you, I don't know, however you want to talk about that case, there's so much interesting info there.
Well, I'll start off by really putting in a plug for this new limited podcast series called American Descent. If you Google it, if you go to the Montpelier website, this was a collaboration between Montpelier and With Good Reason Radio, which you said earlier is a part of Virginia Humanities, and they collaborated on this podcast called American Descent. And it's really looking at the role young people are playing today and in the past to push our country forward and to really challenge some of the systems that have been, you know, perpetuated throughout history. And when episode 2, I actually got to take the producers and staff of Montpelier and With Good Reason to Farmville, Virginia, which is my hometown. It was also the home of Moton High School. And in 1951, the students were fed up with the conditions at this segregated black high school. It was built for 180. It had near 500 students crammed inside of it. You know, the parents had been trying to get a new school built for years, and they were constantly facing obstacles. And finally, the students took matters into their own hands. And so Barbara Johns was 16 years old, and she was able to orchestrate with the committee a strike that went on for 2 weeks. But in the process, they also contacted Oliver Hill and Spotswood Robinson, Virginia's most prominent NAACP civil rights lawyers. And these students and their families decided to sue for an integrated school. And this lawsuit became one of the five cases consolidated into Brown versus the Board of Education. And so it's a really important moment in history that a lot of people, a lot of Virginians even don't really recognize as being significant. But this is, again, 4 years before Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. Martin Luther King Jr. is in graduate school. So he's not really the face of any movement at that point. And you have young people, an hour from here, essentially, who are really laying the groundwork for what becomes a modern civil rights movement. And they produce 75% of the plaintiffs in Brown versus the Board of Education. So I think this is a really important history to know. And I think, it's important to know because, unfortunately, we're still facing so many similar issues, right? When we're thinking about inequity in education, when we're thinking about inequity when it comes to economic opportunities and job opportunities. I mean, these students were facing all of these obstacles, and they said, you know what, we're going to do what our parents and our teachers are too afraid to do. We're going to completely, in a very radical way, challenge the status quo. And, they were able to ultimately win the Supreme Court with the Brown decision in 1954, win the Supreme Court case.
Yeah, and what I learned from you was that wasn't even enough, right? I mean,
right.
Go ahead. I mean, it actually gets worse before it gets better again.
Right. So, Farmville, Prince Edward County has to go before the Supreme Court again and ultimately win in the Griffin versus Prince Edward case, which was handed down in 1964. But in response to the Brown decision, local officials decided to close the public schools, and the schools remained closed for 5 years. So for 5 years in this rural community, you have thousands of children being deprived of a free public education. And, the consequences of that are still being felt to this day. Members of my own family are still feeling the consequences of that to this day. And so it's unfortunate that we're seeing so many parallels today. I mean, we'll hear later about families who are having to be split apart. But, you saw children being sent all across the country just so they could receive an education while the public schools were closed. Parents having to make the difficult decision to send maybe their older children who they felt could handle being away from home, but keeping their younger children behind. And so to this day, you have siblings who don't have the relationship that they would have had they all grown up in the same household. We're seeing intergenerational effects of being deprived of an education for so long. And even when the schools finally reopen, for some students, they were able to persevere and they decided, no matter what, I'm going to graduate from high school, even though I'm 21, 22. But for others, that was an insurmountable obstacle. And, only later in life would they continue their education if they did that at all. So there's so many lessons to be learned, not only from the Brown decision, but also from the 1964 Griffin decision. And I'm so grateful that, so many in the community didn't give up, because had they decided to accept, what was done to them, who knows where public education would be today. They fought to reopen their schools, and that prevented other communities from shutting down theirs.
We are talking with Justin Reed. He's the director of African American Programs at Virginia Humanities. We're going to be right back with more with Justin after this. Also, Priscilla Mendenhall is going to be with us, so stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We are talking with Justin Reed, and just before the break, we were talking about how the schools closed for 5 years. And I just wanted to point out something about that because of Brown, I believe, because of Brown, the state legislature wanted to didn't agree with the policy of stopping segregation. So they closed the schools. And that is, you can correct me if I have this wrong, but a part of something that became known as massive resistance, something maybe we haven't learned as much about, white people haven't learned as much about, that was going on in this country. So I don't know, I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, I mean, I can make some distinctions too, because mass resistance becomes this kind of catch-all term, but it was very nuanced in a lot of ways. And so the Virginia legislature immediately after Brown was already making plans to prevent school desegregation. In many ways, they were making plans before the decision had already been handed down. The first plan really was to build new black schools across Virginia. We call these equalization schools. They thought if we rush to build brand new black high schools, we can undermine the complaint that the NAACP and their plaintiffs are making. And obviously that didn't work. The case continued to make its way through the court and resulted in the 1954 decision. But what you saw, particularly Governor Allman, what you saw him do and the state legislature do is they decided to strip funding from any schools that attempted to integrate. That was really the first phase. And that's how you see schools close in the fall of 1958 in Norfolk, in Charlottesville, and in Warren County in Northern Virginia. The fall of 1958, those schools, select schools in those communities, white schools in those communities are closed to prevent black students from attending them. So the segregated black schools are still open in those three communities. You have a select number of white schools that are being closed to prevent black students from entering them. So you kind of see the idiocy of this plan. And the courts force Governor Allman and the state legislature to step out of the way to allow these schools to integrate. And so after being closed for a semester, Charlottesville schools reopen, Norfolk schools reopen, and Warren County schools reopen. Prince Edward County says, well, if the state can't prevent integration, if the governor can't prevent integration, we'll take matters into our own hands at the local level. And as the county board of supervisors, we can make the decision to not fund our public school system. And so that's when in the fall of 1959, you see the schools close in Prince Edward County and they don't reopen until the Griffin decision forces them to reopen in 1964. So there are these multiple phases of massive resistance. And essentially what Prince Edward County decides to do is after the state has been unsuccessful in keeping the schools closed, they decide to enact their own plan to prevent integration. Mm-hmm. And there's so many, I guess, interesting twists and turns, but, one person in particular, James Bash, who was the principal of Farmville High School, the all-white high school in Prince Edward County, he said he couldn't support this plan for private education. They wanted to just simply create segregated private schools. He was run out of town and he fled to Charlottesville and ended up joining the faculty at Curry and became part of a team of faculty members at Curry who went around the state and helped schools desegregate. And so there are all of these interesting connections between all of these communities in Virginia when it came to school desegregation.
I know Curry had, I had the pleasure of working there for a while, and they, during that time, he was part of what became known as the DeSeg Center, the Desegregation mm-hmm.
yep.
Center.
Yep.
They really helped.
And that came came from his experience in Farmville in the middle of everything that was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And just one of the programs at VA Humanities in the African American department that you are director of, there is that database, the Virginia mm-hmm. African American Historic Sites database.
Right.
Was that started, to reclaim some of this history that, I count myself that had no idea just how bad Was that how that started?
It was. So in the early 2000s, I believe 2001, we began to create these African American historic site trails, and that eventually evolved into being this online database. And we're in the process of redesigning the database and relaunching it next June, June 2019. And a lot of this work right now is being driven by a new task force that the General Assembly recently legislators called the African American Cultural Resources Task Force. And so in my role at Virginia Humanities, I also manage the work of this task force, and they're helping us with this database. But really, it's two prongs. The one issue is that we simply need something to help promote and document and teach about the sites that we already know of. But one of the other challenges, the biggest challenge, is really to try to identify the sites we don't know about. Right now, when we look at our state records, it's around 1% of the sites that are currently in the Virginia Cultural Resource Information System are identified as having African-American historical significance. So we know in a state where people of African descent have lived for 400 years, only 1% of our documented historical resources are identified as having African-American historical significance. We know that's a gross gross underrepresentation. And so how do we redress the fact that, you know, so many of these historic properties aren't listed in our official record? So that's something that we're working with communities around the state to really work through. And there's so many reasons why that is. I mean, you know, a lot of these sites were being entered into the state system in the 60s and 70s, and people weren't talking about slavery the way they are now. So we have entire plantations that are listed in our state record that aren't tagged as having African-American significance. Mm-hmm. So obviously that's incorrect. So, you know, in addition to simply having this database where we can promote, you know, current sites that we know about, there's this larger effort to work with communities to go out and find many sites that haven't been entered into the state system. And, you know, there are a lot of benefits of doing that. One thing, if a site is designated in the National Register of Historic Places, whenever there's a federally funded construction project, like a highway or anything, they actually have to conduct an environmental survey to determine if those historic properties will be disturbed in a negative way. And so if those sites aren't listed in the National Register through our own state system, you know, when there is a highway or when there is a pipeline, there's nothing to indicate that there are cultural resources present. And so it's imperative that we actually get more of this history documented in an official capacity, not just through our informal ways of knowing this history and word of mouth.
That's incredible. Is the ability to contribute to the database or the task force, is that for professionals only, or do you seek out the community, or, you know, can people that live there contribute in whatever way?
No, we're very committed to kind of a grassroots, bottom-up approach when it comes to documenting this history. I mean, it goes without saying that the way we document our history has in many ways perpetuated, right, these inequities. I mean, we've consistently had this top down, you know, kind of in many ways white supremacist approach to documenting Virginia history. And I think that is the reason why we have such a gross underrepresentation of sites connected to marginalized peoples, historically marginalized peoples. And so I have to give a shout out to Preservation Virginia, because one of the things that they've done is created a mobile app that allows people just from their phone to enter in information that they know about a historic site in their community, and that immediately uploads to a larger system. And Preservation Virginia is able to go out and work with communities to better document those sites and apply to have them in the state system.
Do you know what that's called, the app?
Ooh.
We can look it up. I'll post it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's called a kind of historic sites mobile survey or something like that.
But that's great. And we will publicize that. So is the documenting racism's erasing of Black history, is that a project that fits in? Is that a specific project or just a theme?
I think that's a theme of our work. And I think that's a theme that's kind of threaded throughout a lot of our different projects that we're doing.
Yeah.
That one in October, re-envisioning race and education to bring it back to education again. What's going on with that one before you go?
So Virginia Humanities African-American Programs is a co-sponsor of this incredible symposium that the Curry School is hosting, the UVA Curry School. They have a new center, the Center for Race and Public Education in the U.S. South. The center is being headed by Derek Aldridge, and that's taking place on October 9th and 10th. And so you can go to Virginia Humanities website actually and find out more information about the symposium. But a lot of incredible speakers, a lot of great panels. They're going to be focusing on culturally competent education, but also looking at the history of race and racism when it comes to our educational system. And so this is going to be spread across 2 days on October 9th and 10th.
Yeah, I was looking at that. One of the people look amazing. Gloria Ladson Billings. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Her talk is called Hot Sauce in My Bag Swag, Hybridity, Complexity, and Fluidity in 21st Century Racial Identity. She has a lot of credentials, a really interesting looking person. And then James Anderson, also a dean, College of Education at University of Illinois, will be here talking about citizenship, immigration, and national identity. So that is October 9th and 10th at the Curry School.
Yeah, so please come out and support that if you can. And again, I want to plug Derek Aldridge for the amazing work that he's doing with the new center. Definitely recommend him as a guest for
the
show.
We have contacted him, and we will have him on the show. That's for
Derek,
sure.
If you're listening this morning, please come and tell. You know,
we need the Derek Aldridge app.
Yeah.
We'll get him.
Yeah, no, he's incredible.
Yeah. So again, he's the director of that new Center for Race and Public Education in the South at the Curry School. So thank you for being on the show, Justin. Anything that I know there's a lot we didn't cover, but anything you'd like to shout out? Maybe your Twitter handle.
Yeah, if you want to follow me, It's Griffin Boulevard, BLVD, Griffin, like the animal, but it's also named after someone who I greatly admire, Reverend Griffin, who led the civil rights fight in Prince Edward County for so many years. And I guess the last thing that I want to conclude on, you mentioned Virginia Humanities having a name change, and I think we are working really hard to change our approach to a lot of our work, and I want to give a shout out to our new director, Matthew Gibson. He's only the second director that we've had in our 45-year history, and he's only been in the position for a year now. So I think he's bringing a lot of useful energy to the work that we're doing, and I think there are some incredible projects underway. I think like a lot of organizations, we're doing our own internal audit and really assessing our values and the work that we do and our own staff and how we can actually promote equity, particularly when it comes to cultural preservation and education. And so those are serious conversations that are taking place right now within our organization. And so definitely look for that to spill out into a lot of our projects that are underway.
Thank you so much,
thanks,
Justin Reed. And virginiahumanities.org is the website. They do amazing things, and they're just getting better is what I'm gathering. Justin Reed is Director of African American Programs at Virginia Humanities. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Hey, Nancy. So in a moment, we're going to talk with Priscinda Mendenhall.
I heard.
I know. And she was amazing last time, so no pressure, Priscilla, but she's an extremely interesting person. We're going to hear all about her work. But do you have a news of note in the meantime, Nancy?
I do, and it is intentionally chosen because Priscilla is next. We are, as you probably know, so we've moved beyond the zero tolerance policy, and now it's like a less than zero tolerance policy. And what I mean is that it turns out Trump's immigrant roundups are increasingly picking up immigrants that have no criminal record at all. The arrests of non-criminals has increased apparently 66% in the first 9 months of 2018 as opposed to the first 9 months of 2017. And they're not arresting bad hombres. They're just arresting people with no offenses or lesser offenses. Like, I'll give you just this one example. Ariel Vinces Lopez, the charge that led to his deportation proceedings was the mere accusation of riding on the light rail without being able to produce the ticket for being on that car, in that car. He was arrested on suspicion of fare evasion and then turned over to ICE. The charges were later dropped, but he is now still fighting his deportation. And so law enforcement agencies are partnering with ICE and immediately alert the agency if an immigrant comes in contact with a police officer, even if they didn't commit a crime. Like if you were in a car accident and it wasn't your fault, this could happen to you as an immigrant. As it keeps being held true that studies continue to show immigrants still have a much lower level of criminality than the rest of us here, the citizens. And that's what I got. What do you got?
Yeah.
Is there something? Unless I took
Thanks.
It all up.
I'm no, sure. No. Well, I just wanted to say there's a scathing article in Politico, and this is the title, Stephen Miller is an Immigration Hypocrite. I know because I'm his uncle. So this guy, Dr. David Glosser, wanted to clear his family name and say that they stand for asylum seekers and immigrants and that the policies are very dangerous, obviously, to American citizens as well, because it's an attack on democracy. And he goes on, he was interviewed by Democracy Now! As well. Stephen Miller, as we all know, is the evil mind behind a lot of Trump's politics. And so it's a really interesting article. And another point brought out in that article is that Stephen Miller's childhood rabbi, Rabbi Neil Cornish Daniels of Beth Shear Shalom, denounced Miller during the Rosh Hashanah sermon earlier this month, and he called him a purveyor of negativity, violence, malice, and brutality. He said, Mr. Miller, you've set back the Jewish contribution to making the world spiritually whole through your arbitrary division of these desperate people. The actions that you now encourage President Trump to take make it obvious to me that you didn't get my or our Jewish message. So, I mean, I just have a lot of, you know, horrible, hateful feelings for his policies, I must say.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting that his uncle wanted to speak out.
Yeah, that is. I know.
So we're going to have to go to a hard break. We'll make it short, and we'll be right back with Priscilla Mendenhall. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Apropos of Something. It's also 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. So I wanted to introduce Priscilla Mendenhall. We've been talking a lot about her work, things that she is involved with. She's an equity activist. She's been advocating for immigrants' rights for over 40 years. In early 2017, she created CRAC, the Charlottesville Area Immigrant Resource and Advocacy Coalition. She was here a year ago on this program, illuminating CRAC's work to give hope and help to families in peril because of the inhumane conditions imposed upon them by this administration. And we're going to hear an update about what immigrants in our community face on a daily basis and what you can do to get involved. Welcome to the program, Priscilla.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, I should say welcome back. So tell us what has changed in our community since you started CRAC.
I think what's changed in the community is exactly what Nancy was describing, is that the measures that this administration are taking are increasingly draconian, and they are having a very clear impact on families, on children, on the entire, our entire community, and particularly folks who are not undocumented.
Would you say the focus of your organization now is basically trying to keep up with what ICE is doing, but, you know, the perniciousness of ICE?
I would say that's certainly at a center of what we're doing. We did form in early 2017, and I wouldn't say that I created it. I work with a whole lot of wonderful people and organizations in town. I'm a part of the planning committee at CRAC. But certainly ICE's increasing presence in our community and the connection between our local regional jail and ICE are absolutely at the center of what we do. ICE's presence affects families here on a daily basis. I'll give one example. CRAC's folks have created a network of drivers who provide transportation for folks in this community as they go up to their hearings in Northern Virginia. And we also provide rides increasingly locally for folks who are too afraid to get in their cars and take their children to school or to go to medical appointments. And it should be said for those who do not know, and folks who might be listening from outside Virginia, that in Virginia, if you do not have legal status, you cannot get a driver's license. So any time a person without documents gets in a car, they are putting themselves and their family at risk. And that is one way in which people are pulled over, say, for a broken taillight. It's shown that they don't have a driver's license. They get arrested. They get taken to jail. And then they're put into what is a national database when they get arrested and put in jail. That information goes to ICE. And when they're due to be released, ICE shows up and takes them and puts them into detention and deportation proceedings. So simply from taking your child to school, you will be put into deportation proceedings.
And what is going on with, I hear a lot about what's going on in the Albemarle Seville jails here in terms of the notifications. And we talked to Deirdre Enright a few weeks ago about a case that, you know, it was a lot of horrible things about that misdiagnosed case of shaken baby syndrome, where the moment she was going to be, you know, out of custody, she was going to be picked up by ICE.
Right. Right, and that case was actually a case in Fluvanna County. That's not an Albemarle County case. I'm familiar with it, however. The bigger context for this is basically that something in the neighborhood of 70% of ICE pickups now are from regional jails and facilities around the country. Those facilities are doing ICE's job for it. when someone is brought into a jail like our jail, who and demonstrated to be unknown or undocumented, ICE will issue what's called a detainer on that person, simply for because they are actually present in the United States. They issue a detainer. It doesn't mean that the person has committed any other crime. They will issue a detainer, and part of that detainer notification is a request that the jail actually hold the person 48 hours past their release date so that ICE can pick them up. The second part of it is a notification. And what that notification is purely voluntary on the part of the jail. What it means is that jail staff, when they know someone is due to be released, will call ICE 48 hours before they're due to be released to say, hey, this person's getting out on Wednesday. You need to show up and pick them up. Wow. So we have joined with a number of other powerful organizations in town, including Legal Aid and Surge and Black Lives Matter, to counter that policy at the jail. And this has been ongoing since last January.
How are you doing that?
I would say that it's being fought on a number of different levels. One is a purely kind of legal level, which is the notifications are voluntary, but if the jail board is going to decide to maintain the notification policy, that then they should be demanding that ICE show up with actually a judge-signed warrant, because ICE typically shows up with a warrant that's a purely internal ICE document. So the folks from Legal Aid are fighting on that level. We are fighting on a number of grounds that have to do with constitutional protections for persons who may not have papers but are nonetheless protected in the Constitution. And we're also simply making the point that this is not acceptable in our community, and that it's also a powerful detriment to public safety. When people in our community who do not have documents are afraid of calling the police to report, and people who may be documented, may be citizens, are increasingly mistrustful of law enforcement because law enforcement is complicit in furthering ICE's agenda, then that's a detriment to all of our public safety, and it's of interest to all of us.
Right. I mean, that is astounding, just the levels at which everything is falling apart or designed to keep immigrants quiet or scared beyond, as you know best. So I will shut up about that part. I was just wondering, in general, not in general, or as specific as you want to be, but the way you just described all that, it sounds like laws are just being overlooked or disregarded, or constitutional rights the same. Is that fair to say?
Doing
what they want?
I think it's very fair to say, and I would, you know, you asked me earlier what's changed in the last year, and I think for us what's changed apart from what the administration is doing is the realization that the administration's agenda, their anti-immigrant agenda, is part of a broader agenda to make this country white again, which it never was, but in their view, to make this country white again, and that ICE and, by extension, Customs and Border Patrol are tools of that agenda. It's white nationalism, it's white supremacy in another guise, and perhaps because, you know, this is Charlottesville, right? And we've all been through some other experiences that feed into this. This has become extremely clear to us. What's also become clear to us at CRAC, and we're launching a kind of public education campaign in the next little while, is that this is nothing new. Separating children in this country, and Justin alluded to that with regard to kids in Farmville being separated from family so they could get an education. Separating children from family began 400 years ago with chattel slavery. It continued with Native American children, Japanese internment. I could go on and on. So separating children is not new. It's not new in Seville. It's not new around the country. Families here are seeing, you know, themselves being separated from their children. But we need to understand that history. We also need to understand the rest of what the history of our immigration policies have been and how they are tied to a long, long story of U.S. intervention south of the border, starting with the Monroe Doctrine. So it's really important for all of us to come to terms with the fact that we can't fight what's going on right now unless we understand all this and unless our fight is rooted in those struggles.
I was wondering, Priscilla, speaking of laws, how do you engage with like local lawmakers or state lawmakers?
CERAC itself isn't as involved in engaging with local lawmakers. We work very closely with the folks at the Legal Aid Justice Center, and with other attorneys in town who have kind of more connections. Having said that, we do engage with folks who aren't, they're policymakers, not lawmakers. In other words, our regional jail is governed by a board of 11 people. Some of those folks are the local sheriffs and county administrators who are automatically on the board, but some of them are also citizen representatives. So we've been in a pretty active campaign of engaging them individually around the issue of notifications and some other issues having to do with the jail. So they're the folks who can influence the policy around notifications, and it is very, very important for us to do that work. It's pretty challenging because the processes by which folks are chosen for the board, that particularly the citizen reps, are somewhat opaque, and we're in the process of trying to illuminate those as there's a position that's come up and needs to be filled before the next jail board vote in November. So we're very actively involved in trying to figure out how it is. We know how people apply, but we don't know how they're actually selected.
I wanted you to speak about something that you had brought up that's coming up.
Yes. So one of the things that we've gotten engaged in and we're incubating is the Seville Immigrant Bond Fund. I don't know if folks are aware of this, but immigrant bond, once someone is taken into ICE detention, if they're lucky, they get the bond is set. Those bonds range from about $3,500 up to $50,000. They need to be paid in one shot in cash. So it's prohibitively expensive for families. And our aim in setting up the Seville Immigrant Bond Fund is to assist families in paying that bond so that they don't have to go to private bond companies that are at best extortion artists. And I could go on about that at great length. So we are launching the Seville Immigrant Bond Fund on October 19th, which with a dance party at the kitchen.
Yay.
Y'all, exactly.
Nancy's coming for that. I know you are.
Yes, we are. We're actually working kind of under Plumas and Dreamers on Grounds at UVA. They're young Latinx organizations, and they will be taking the lead on organizing the event. We're just there to provide backup. And with thanks to The Kitchen, which is a local catering operation that is offering us their space. So join us 6 p.m. to 1:30 a.m. last call. I will be asleep. But we will provide music, and there'll be great food and really a good time to launch what is an essential part of what needs to happen to counter ICE.
So that's October 19th, and where?
At The Kitchen on Ravana. 606 Ravana Avenue in Charlottesville.
That cool.
Could be an incorrect address. So
okay.
Look for save the dates and listen to a PSA on the station.
Yeah, you've got Facebook. I saw it. So
exactly.
Okay.
You know, actually, Priscilla, speaking of Facebook, you mentioned to me, so that was a horrible setup. I was curious if you would share the experience you've had with ICE actually finding CERAC online and commenting. Go ahead.
Well, there are a couple of things, one of which I hadn't mentioned to you. The first time that folks at CERAC posted something kind of pithy on our Facebook page, our email address was hacked from New York State. We got a Google security note. Like, it was the first day, and this happened kind of in the middle of the night. What I had mentioned to you was the fact that, and this is not apropos of somebody who's part of CERAC, she's an ally in another part of the state, but this is someone who's fairly out there, and she was at a rally recently, and an ICE or some other federal person came over to her, addressed her by name, and referenced some things that she had been involved in that had to do with her personal life. So know that ICE and other federal agencies are doing facial recognition everywhere we go. And we all had our pictures taken at the last jail board meeting by someone who is certainly allied with the feds. That's very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. So get involved. Nevertheless, like those women in the elevators, it doesn't matter. We really need to, if this is a cause that speaks to you, look for CIRAC online at CIRAC.Weebly.com or just Google CIRAC, correct?
And or email us.
Or email them. And we'll put this on the WPVC website. And what other, very quickly, ways that people can get involved or things that you'd like to have our listeners know?
Again, as I said, CIRAC has a whole transportation network of amazing people who drive folks all around the state because they need to be driven. We also have a group of folks who do visitation at the detention center in Farmville, where Justin comes from. I'm not blaming him. I'm just mentioning that that's his hometown. Feel free to email me and get involved in our advocacy work. We're also with Legal Aid and Sin Barreras, part of a rapid response network that is designed to come into action when ICE comes into town. So please reach out. We do answer our email. There are a couple of us who answer the emails. You may hear from both of us. Just go with it because we're just on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, thank Priscilla Mendenhall.
And thank you for having me.
Yes, come back anytime. This has nothing to do with what we just spoke about because it's a palate cleanser. So,
continue.
I love when the guests laugh.
Apply generously.
All right. So my palate cleanser is the trivia I alluded to earlier. So, yes. So you can contact us in many ways. AOSRadio947 is the email at Gmail. AOSRadio947 at Gmail. Or Facebook or Twitter, AOS Radio. So the question is, where was the high school that we mentioned where the teenagers struck? Not necessarily the name of the high school, but I didn't mention on the program, and I wanted to squeeze that in here now, that there's a museum there now that really celebrates or commemorates the events that we had been speaking about. So what is the town in Virginia? Let us know.
Good one, Ellen.
Okay, what about you, Nance? What's your palate cleanser?
I cannot segue. I wouldn't even try. Scientists from Queen Mary University of London conducted a 3-month study of, 35 goats and found, found that the goats could discern differences in human facial expressions and they preferred to interact with positive faces. The goats looked at pairs of black and white photos of the same face, same individual, showing happy and angry facial expressions, and to a snout, they preferred happy people. The point being, it's not just house pets that hang out, you know, with humans a lot. All animals, it appears, or more animals, read us, and so it's a note to farmers out there, you know, be mindful of how you interact with your livestock and other species. The best part, honestly, Ellen, of this story is that this is going on. No, but the best part is the research was conducted at Buttercup's Sanctuary for Goats in Kent, England. I mean, Buttercup. You got to hand it to those people for the names.
Yes. Well, that was a great story. I love it. Anything with cute animals. Cute little goats. Goats are fun. I don't know. Have you ever spent time with goats, Nance?
No, not that I recall.
Right. In New York City,
I can be all testament.
Sure there's a dearth of goats in New York City, but there are goats walking around here, and they're very playful, and they eat everything. Just my kind of people.
I'm glad I mentioned it, because you all should, show them your happy face.
We should hang out.
They'll appreciate it.
Yes. So I just wanted to say it's really fun being back live on the program this fall. We have a lot of great guests coming up. Our theme music is by Springtide. Remember that no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Thanks to our guest, Justin Reed of Virginia Humanities, Priscilla Mendenhall of CIRAC. And thank you, Nancy. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you. Okay.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.